Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bylaw 241, and it is September 7th. And don't forget, we're going to have a test Thursday. So you need your Scantron 882E, 882ES works just fine, good pencil, but you got to have a super eraser, right? You got to make sure you have an eraser that doesn't smudge up your Scantron. That's really important. And once again, the chapters are 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. And we got just a couple slides on 6 yet to go over. And I elected to postpone the test one day. Sorry about that, because we were going pretty fast through some of the material in 6. And it's not the maybe easiest chapter in the class. So I thought maybe we should spend some time a little bit more on 6 and finish it up properly. All right, so you have an hour and a half to take the test next time. Let's see. No hats, hood, sunglasses. Don't wear anything that will conceal your identity. If you're wearing a cap, just put it backwards, right? That's no big deal. And you need, oh yeah, one last thing. A basic scientific calculator for doing some calculations. So make sure you know how to use that log button. Everybody's calculator is a little bit different. I'll have a calculator that you can use in here, but if it's not the exact one that you've used at home, and that might work exactly the same way, right? Some calculators have parentheses that you put numbers in, and then you hit log, and others you do different things with. So make sure you have practice with your calculator. And here's basically on the board, I wrote how you calculate the pH from a hydrogen ion concentration, or how do you calculate the hydrogen ion concentration from pH, right? So these are the ways that I like to do it. I usually don't mess around with the minus log. I usually work with inverses, which is exactly the same thing, but in my way of thinking, it's easier to just take the inverse of the hydrogen ion concentration and then take the log of that to give you pH. Okay, and then here, if somebody gives you the pH, right, put the pH as an exponent to the base 10 of something, then take the inverse of it, and that's the hydrogen ion concentration. So it's pretty easy once you get the hang of it to do that kind of thing. Now, you could use a log function to calculate something else. What else could you do? You have to use a log function to calculate? The Nernst equation, the equilibrium potential of something, right? So I think I just want to review that pretty quickly. So here we have the PowerPoint slide. Maybe I'll turn off one of these lights right here. I don't know which, I think this is good like that. Okay. And let's pretend there are no, I got to get my pointer working. Hold on. All right, let's pretend that there are no fixed ions inside the cell. All right, and of course, that's nonsense. There are fixed anions inside the cell, like proteins, right, for instance. All right, but let's pretend that there are no fixed anions inside the cell. And this particular ion right here, how would you characterize this ion that I'm pointing to? That's a what? Yeah, it's a cation. What kind of cation? Monovalent cation. It has one charge on it, right? And it's got to be a plus charge if it's a cation. So here's a monovalent cation. If there's no fixed anions inside the cell, what would be the concentration of these ions across the cell membrane? If it could diffuse across, things will move from high to low. But let's wait a week. What will happen after a week? What will be the concentration? They will be equal. That's right, because of diffusion. It's a passive process, so you'll have the same number of cations, the same concentration inside compared to outside of the cell. And these are charged particles. And if you have an equal concentration, what's going to be the difference in charge? There's no difference in charge. Yeah, no difference in charge. All right, but now let's put some fixed anions inside the cell, which means what? What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So some of these positive charges are going to be attracted to the inside of the cell, right? To negate some of those or to cancel out negative charges. So then that means what? That means that there's going to be more positive charges inside than outside. Okay, but the positive charges can't completely neutralize all of the fixed anions, because that means then you'd have a huge concentration of these cations inside the cell. And there's a force that is going to try to push some of those out, and that is what we call what? Diffusion. All right, so the equilibrium potential for one ion can be calculated using that Nernst equation that shows us what the new equilibrium is. That balances out what the electrical attraction inside the cell with the concentration gradient that's trying to push these cations outside the cell. So that's a new equilibrium, right? And it will tell you what the residual electrical charge will be inside the cell as a result of that. And that's the equilibrium potential. And you can calculate that for various ions, right? For calcium, chloride, potassium, or sodium, if you know what the concentration is inside and the concentration outside, using this equation right here. Oh, you can't memorize. You should know how to calculate it for anything. Okay, you should know how to use this equation right here. Now, what does Z mean? Z represents the? Yeah, the valence of a particular ion. Whether, and it could be what? Plus 1, minus 1, plus 2, minus 2. And you would put that into Z right here before you complete the calculation. Okay. So that will tell you that. So which ion? So make sure you know. Now, one thing I do want you to memorize for these four ions, where they are high and where they are low for these four ions. You don't have to know for any other ions, but for these four, it's important. All right, so which ones are high on the outside? Sodium, chlorine, and calcium. So that means that potassium is the only one that's high on the inside of the cell. Right, because we're going to understand some electrophysiology of the nervous system sometime real soon. And it would be good for you to memorize that. Okay, last thing I want to say. Now, some of this stuff is really interesting. You've never run into it before. A lot of people haven't really even studied chemistry before. So this is pretty abstract stuff. So when I say something that's very abstract to you the first time, right, it probably goes right over the top of your head. How do you protect yourself from feeling lost in lecture? What's a step that you should do before lecture so that things don't go right over the top of your head? Yeah, the pre-lecture reading assignment. Okay, so if you're feeling totally lost in lecture and you're not doing the pre-lecture reading assignment, you can help yourself out a lot by doing what? The pre-lecture reading assignment and spending a little time with the information before class. And that will make lecture a whole lot more fun. Okay, because every once in a while I see some people with like their eyes glazed over in lecture. And I understand why, sometimes, okay, and doing the pre-lecture reading assignment can help you with that. Okay, so our last thing that we have to talk about is cell signaling, all right, but before we get there, what are some other important key things that you should know? Sodium-potassium pump is so important. Most of the energy that you consume every day in your food goes to operate these pumps that are inside all of your cells, the sodium-potassium pump, ATP pump. All right, so this is what? Active transport. These molecules go from where to where? Low concentration to high concentration. All right, so potassium is going inside the cell, and where is potassium high?
Inside.
That's right, so that's got to be a pump. Sodium goes to the outside of the cell. Where is sodium high?
Outside,
so that has to be an active transport process as well. All right, and the sodium-potassium ATP pump is not equal for the number of ions that it transports, right? It's two potassiums for every three sodiums. That also helps make the inside of the cell, what, more negative compared to the outside because it pumps unequal numbers of ions. So there are a number of things that make the inside of the cell negative compared to the outside, and you should know that a general cell, right, the generally agreed-to number is that on the inside compared to the outside, it's about minus 70 millivolts, right? So that's not at equilibrium, right? That takes energy to maintain that. And that's what we call RMP. What is RMP? Resting membrane potential. So every cell, every living cell in your body, if it's alive, acts like a battery, acts like a battery, and there is energy, right? Anytime you have a battery that's charged up or there's a gradient, if there's a difference in charge or a difference in concentration, that can be used to do work or transmit information. Okay, all right, so now we're into cell signaling. It's important that your body is coordinated, that all of your cells coordinate with each other to maintain homeostasis. And I in anatomy classes, I like to use this kind of construct, and it's called the structural and functional unit of something. And I think even in this class, I asked you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? What's the basic building block of life? And that's the cell, right? So if you want to understand something about life, you got to know how the cell functions, right? But you got to know that if anything's alive, it's got to be built out of cells. And let's see, what else did we talk about in here? Maybe that's about it. Okay, here's another structural and functional unit. But this is of communication between two cells, right? So not one cell and the rest of your body, but between one cell going to another cell, and that's called a synapse. And I want to break the synapse down into two general kinds of synapses. How is it that one cell can actually communicate with another cell? That's always going to be through a synapse. Some are electrical. Some send electrical signals through using various kinds of ions, because ions are what? Have an electrical charge on them, so that changes the electrical property of the neighboring cell. And another kind is a chemical signal. So one cell secretes a chemical and the other cell can sense that chemical. All right, how is it that the receiving cell can sense a chemical that's being sent to it from another cell? What does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor, and the shape of the signaling molecule has to be complementary to the receptor. They have to fit together. They have to have the right shape. Okay. So here is the first kind of synapse. And remember, these are neighboring cells, right? Here's one cell. Here's the other one down over here. And this is an example of an electrical synapse. The electrical synapse is based on this tunnel that goes from the top cell to the bottom cell, so that if the concentration of an ion increases in the top cell, for instance, maybe sodium concentration increases in the top cell, and it's low in the bottom cell, guess what happens to sodium? It goes through this little tunnel right here. And when that positive charge enters the cell on the bottom, guess what happens to its resting membrane potential? Does it get more negative or more positive? It gets more positive. So the electrical state of the cell changes when it has these gap junctions, right? So a gap junction is the structural basis for an electrical synapse. Not many cells have gap junctions or electrical synapses, because it means that if the top cell becomes stimulated, then automatically the bottom cell becomes stimulated, right? And that's really good for some organs, like the heart, because the heart should contract as a unit, right? But gap junctions are not a synapse that all of your skeletal muscles should have. Why do you think of that? What's a good way to think of that? Why is it good that skeletal muscles don't have gap junctions or electrical synapses? Because if one muscle contracted, what would that mean? Your whole body would contract. And then, of course, you wouldn't have control over your body at all, right? But for your heart, that's perfect, right? So electrical synapses due to gap junctions work really well for certain circumstances, but not many. Other kinds of synapses, actually I'm going to go back to that other slide. All right, here's a really good one. This is what we call the neuromuscular junction. This is a synapse, right? Here's one cell controlling another cell, the skeletal muscle. All right, this is what we call a chemical synapse. So information flows down this neuron as an electrical signal. When the electrical signal reaches the axon terminus, right? So hopefully you all know that this is like what part of the neuron is this right here? That's a cell body, right? That's just from anatomy. And then these are the dendrites, right? This is the receiving end of a neuron. This is part of then the sending part, the soma and the axon right here. And when that electrical signal gets down to the very end of the axon, we call the axon terminus, then the neuron releases a chemical, which we then call a neurotransmitter. And that chemical then binds to a receptor on the skeletal muscle, which causes it to contract. And when the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, that establishes another electrical event in the muscle. And that electrical event causes the muscle to contract. So the way information travels through a chemical synapse is that in the neuron, it's an electrical signal. Across the synapse, it's what kind of signal? A chemical signal, and then when that chemical signal reaches this effector organ, it becomes an electrical signal once again. So it goes what? Electrical, chemical, electrical. That's how a chemical synapse works. But an electrical synapse, how does that work? It's all electrical, carried by ions, right? The information doesn't have to be converted into a neurotransmitter. Okay. Oops, wrong way. All right, so which type of synapse is a gap junction? That's a good one to be able to answer. That's a nice, simple electrical synapse, right? And what kind of questions do I have right here? What must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor? Where do you have the receptors? Those are on the skeletal muscle. What's the shape of that receptor for a neurotransmitter? What's the best way of thinking of that? One word, we could say it's complementary, right? Can't be the same shape. It's got to be complementary. One has got to fit inside the other in order for it to bind. And some models we use in our mind to say that would be like lock and key model, right? A key doesn't have the exact same shape as the lock. It's what? Complementary to it, right? Or hand and glove, right? That's complementary, so your hand can fit inside the glove. All right, let's go back to another one, previous slide. All right, so for paracrine signaling, that's when one cell secretes some kind of signaling molecule, it diffuses to nearby cells, and it's going to change the activity or metabolism or chemistry of a neighboring cell. But once again, these neighboring cells right here have to have a receptor in order to sense these paracrine agents from the cell that's trying to communicate with it. All right, we don't really call these neurotransmitters. We don't really call this a synapse because this signaling molecule could affect a whole range of cells, a whole neighborhood of cells, not just one nearby cell. All right, so for a synapse, it's usually just one cell that's right next to the cell that's trying to communicate with it. All right, but nonetheless, these signaling molecules move from one place to another only by diffusion. That's the only way these signaling molecules move around. All right, so what must the target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? It's got to have that receptor, and now you know the structural relationship between the signaling molecule and the receptor. In one word, you'd say what? It's got to be complementary. All right, what must be the shape? Oh, that's the second question right here. What must be the shape of complementary? Right, so that's not such a big deal. All right, one other mode of signaling, and again, this is not just one cell talking with another cell. This is maybe one cell or a group of cells talking with the whole body, a whole, you know, it could be billions of cells. And this is what we call endocrine signaling, where a cell secretes a chemical signal molecule, or you could say chemical regulator. Okay, and let's just stop and think about what a gland is. Glands can have different forms, and we can break all glands down into two major categories. Can anybody remember what the two major categories are? Endocrine and exocrine. So what's the difference? One has ducts and the other doesn't, is ductless. All right, so which one is which? Exocrine has ducts, like a sweat gland has a duct. That's a good example of an exocrine gland. All right, now on the slide, do you see a duct anywhere? Ah, a little confusing. I see a tube, but that's not a duct. That's not a duct of the gland. That's just a blood vessel. All right, so here we have a gland that's secreting a product. Okay, and it does not go into a duct. So that means it's an endocrine gland. It's a ductless gland. But how does that signaling molecule get all over your body if there's no duct to take it where it's going to go? It gets absorbed by the blood. Okay, so here it moves into this blood vessel right here. And then from anatomy, you can tell me what kind of blood vessel that is. Classify that blood vessel for me. How many layers do you see? I just see one. What kind of blood vessel just has one layer? A capillary, right? It's just a simple squamous epithelium. But since it's lining that tube, we call it an endothelium, right? The endothelial lining of a capillary is just a simple squamous epithelium. So this signaling molecule can diffuse across without much difficulty because it's so thin. And now it's in the blood. And where does blood take it? Everywhere in the body, right? So it's a ductless gland, right? An endocrine gland is a ductless gland because you use the cardiovascular system to distribute that signaling molecule, not a duct. All right, and then it goes to another capillary someplace where it moves out of the blood into the interstitial space right here. How does it move? How does it get out of the blood? What's the physical process? Diffusion, which means what? high concentration to low concentration, right? It just moves out of the blood, and it's going to bump into various cells, but it can only change the behavior of certain cells because only certain cells have what? The receptor for it, right? And then it changes the activity of these cells. So these cells way over here can change the activity of these cells because these cells have a receptor. All right, so a nice way of thinking about an endocrine gland or hormone is that a hormone is secreted by a ductless gland, right, which is distributed by the blood, right, which binds to a distant target tissue, which causes a specific response of this target tissue right here. And it causes a specific response because the target tissue has a receptor for that particular hormone. All right, so let me see about this question right here. What must be the shape of the binding site of the hormone receptor? It must be complementary somehow, right? So by shape, these things recognize each other by shape. And if you change the shape, what happens? Something changes, usually for the worse, right? It's got to have the right shape for it to work. Okay. All right. So we were looking at a bunch of chemicals in the one of the previous chapters, and we can kind of break chemicals down into two main categories by where they'd like to spend their time. What are the two main regions where chemicals like to spend their time, and how do we talk about these, the natures of chemicals? Yeah, that's exactly how I'm thinking, right? We could think of a chemical, and we could say it either likes to dissolve in water or it doesn't like to dissolve in water. Where one is hydrophilic and the other nature is hydrophobic, right? So that's a really good way to break chemicals down if you want to characterize them. Okay, so first let's talk about hydrophobic regulatory molecules. And these could be a hormone, for instance, or some other kind of paracrine agent. If it's hydrophobic, what does that mean? What is it like? It likes lipids. It doesn't like water. It doesn't like to be in water. All right, and if it's hydrophobic, what kind of barrier is the plasma membrane to it? Is it a significant barrier, or do hydrophobic molecules just move right through it? Because the plasma membrane is a phospholipid structure, a hydrophobic molecule can go right through the plasma membrane, can diffuse into the cell just by concentration gradient, right? So a hydrophobic signaling molecule can enter the cell. So the receptors for hydrophobic regulatory molecules are inside the cell. They can be cytoplasmic, or they can even be inside the nucleus. They can be in the nucleus or in the cytoplasm, either one. Right? And then when they bind to this receptor, it's going to change transcription. And transcription is the beginning of what process? Protein synthesis, and that happens inside the nucleus. So a number of hormones, including steroids, thyroid hormones, nitric oxide, can enter the cell and can change events inside the nucleus to start protein synthesis. And that could produce other signaling molecules or enzymes, which is going to change the behavior of this cell right here, right? So lipid-soluble molecules can enter the cell without difficulty because the plasma membrane is not a barrier to it. But the plasma membrane is a barrier to what kind of compound? The hydrophilic kind of compound, because the hydrophilic can't get through, right, this interior part of the phospholipid membrane. So I think this is what we have on this slide right here. Yeah, the hydrophilic regulatory molecules, just because they like to dissolve in water, they're excluded from the cell. That's kind of an odd concept, but because they like to dissolve in water, they can't get inside cells because of the phospholipid bilayer right here. So if there is a signaling molecule on the inside, how on earth can it change anything on the inside of the cell if it can't get in there and make a change happen? All right, so here is a very interesting process of what we call signal transduction. Signal transduction is taking a signal from outside the cell, and how does it make changes on the inside without actually going in itself? All right, that is a very interesting, and a lot of people got a lot of Nobel Prizes for figuring some of this stuff out. Okay, well, if the signaling molecule can't get inside the cell, can there be receptors inside the cell that will make a difference? No. Well, it won't, because if the signaling molecule can't get in, it can't bind to a receptor that is a nuclear receptor or a cytoplasmic receptor. So So the receptors have to be on the outside of the cell. So here I see a number of receptors, and where are they? They are extracellular. They're part of the membrane, but the receptor part is what? Sticking toward the outside of the cell, so that when a hydrophilic signaling molecule bumps up against the cell, it can still bind to this receptor right here. It doesn't have to get inside the cell, it binds to the outside. All right, and so once it binds, then it will produce other signals inside the cell. And those other signals then can regulate the activity of the cell. So the one that binds to the outside is what we call the first messenger. The second chemical compound that develops inside the cell is what we call a second messenger. They're not the same compound. They're going to be different compounds. But as the concentration of the first messenger increases, guess what happens to the concentration of the second? It's directly related. It goes up, right? So that's why the first messenger can control things that are happening inside the cell. And when the concentration of the second messenger goes down, what does that mean? The concentration of the first messenger goes down too. They're directly related to each other. Okay. So some good questions would be, where is the first messenger always located? It's always outside the cell. Why is that? Because it can't get in because it's a hydrophilic compound, right? It's a watery compound, can't get through the plasma membrane. Okay, where's the second messenger always located? Inside the cell. What's that process called of going from when a first messenger causes the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell? That's signal transduction. Yeah, we're going to look at some of that process quite a bit. All right, so hydrophilic compounds have receptors in the plasma membrane, not cytoplasmic. All right, so that's a real important concept. So the shape of these receptor molecules right there, that's a really nice shape. Okay, and that reminds me of a G protein coupled receptor. And this is an integral protein. What does an integral protein mean? It's a very important part of the plasma membrane. It's stuck in the membrane. It goes all the way across, right, from extracellular to the intracellular side. If we were to take this protein out of the membrane, we'd actually destroy the membrane. So it's an integral part of the membrane. And when something happens out over here, since it's one molecule, then something happens on the inside of the cell, right? Something happens on the outside, like binding of a first messenger. Something's going to happen to this interior part of this G protein. Okay. The G protein can cause a buildup of various second messengers that we're going to look at through the remainder of the class. So I just give you a list of what some of these are. It could be ions, right? Like a calcium ion. Now from that previous slide, where is the calcium ion concentration high and where is it really, really low? High outside and it's almost zero inside. Right, so that's a perfect signaling molecule to have inside the cell because basically it's zero inside the cell unless something tells it to increase. And then it can be used as a signal for controlling something inside the cell. So calcium is a great example of a second messenger. All right, another good example would be cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP just has one phosphate on it. There is a related compound that has three phosphates on it. What would that be called? And it still has adenosine as the base. That would be adenosine triphosphate, right? So adenosine triphosphate can be converted into cyclic adenosine monophosphate. Mono means it has one. Two phosphates are taken off by an enzyme, and now this becomes a very important signaling molecule, changes the metabolism inside the cell. Okay, G proteins, what I showed you on the previous slide, there's some other chemical compounds that you can call DAG and IPI3. I'll talk about those a little bit later. That's diacyl glycerol. I'm not going to ask you to draw that out or even say the name. You could just say DAG. That's an important second messenger. Where do you find DAG? Inside the cell, yeah. And what about inositol 3-phosphate? I won't ask you to say that. You can just say what? IPI3. That's, where do you find IPI3? Inside the cell. That's an important signaling molecule that builds up inside the cell as a result of what? An increase in the first messenger outside the cell. All right, so here are some examples of important second messengers. All right, and the G protein coupled receptor is probably one of the most important signal transduction mechanisms that we have in our body. And it's really interesting because I would say, I might be wrong, okay, so you might not, this might not be true, but I would say all living cells have G protein coupled receptors. It's one of the most highly conserved signal transduction schemes in living systems. So bacteria have them. We can probably find them in viruses. Even though they're not alive, they have these ways of transducing signals from the outside environment to their inside environment. And eukaryotic cells have G protein coupled receptors. Prokaryotic cells, like bacteria, have them. All right, so this is a system that we have in common with everything that's alive. It's pretty amazing. It's almost like the genetic code. Okay, so G protein coupled receptors are part of a second messenger pathway, right? So they're important for signal transduction. It contains three subunits whose components dissociate when a cell's surface receptor becomes activated. And a cell surface receptor is activated when it binds a signaling molecule, right? And in particular, which one, the first messenger or second messenger? The first messenger on the outside of the cell. All right, so the G protein becomes activated when a first messenger binds to it. All right, and then those subunits dissociate and wander around inside the plasma membrane, and they can bump into other kinds of proteins that are in the membrane, like a channel or maybe an enzyme, and it can change the state of that ion channel by either closing it or opening it, or by activating or deactivating various enzymes. All right, so here is a pretty important exam figure. We'll be using this as a basis to understand a lot of activity, a lot of physiology in the cell later throughout the class, so it's really good for you to kind of be able to memorize this thing. All right, so when we look at this slide, what do we see right where I have the cursor? What do we got right here? Phospholipid bilayer, right? So that's really just a plasma membrane. All right, but remember, what's a better way of thinking of a cell membrane? Not just a phospholipid bilayer, but what? Fluid mosaic model. Your cell puts in proteins, all kinds of different proteins into the plasma membrane. In this particular case, right, the G protein coupled receptor. And here is the active site. This is the part that can bind something extracellular, a signaling molecule that's extracellular. So what would this thing be? First messenger or second messenger? First messenger, and this also means that what about this little blue dot? Can it get inside the cell? No. Why can't it get inside the cell? You could say, oh, because it's blue. That wouldn't be good. And you could say, oh, because it's round. But that's not good. You know that it is hydrophilic. It can't get through the bilayer right here, right? So it's hydrophilic, can't get through. But it can still change activity inside the cell because of this signal transduction scheme, which is the G protein coupled receptor. All right, so it binds. Here are the three subunits of the G protein. We call it a G protein because it binds a high energy molecule very similar to ATP. It's a little bit different because the base is guanosine. So it's GTP. Nonetheless, it's a high energy molecule. It can bind to this big subunit right here, which we're going to call subunit number one. But instead of calling it number one, the first letter of the alphabet is A or alpha. So here, that's an alpha, right? That's just Greek alpha. So here is the alpha subunit. When it binds, this guanosine diphosphate is released, okay? And this complex is now activated because the first messenger has been bound to the receptor right here. Now, where do you find this alpha, beta, and gamma? Beta means the second one. Gamma just means the last one, the G unit right here, gamma. Where is alpha, beta, gamma located? Extracellular or intracellular? They're intracellular, right? So these subunits become activated, and they can dissociate. They break apart, right? The alpha goes its own way. The beta and gamma goes its own way. So the beta and gamma kind of stick together all the time. And they wander around on the surface, the inside surface of the plasma membrane. Because what's really a really good way to think of a plasma membrane? Not just a phospholipid bilayer, but what? Fluid mosaic model, which means what? Things are floating around and something's floating. It can move around very easily, move by just diffusion, right through around on the inside surface of the plasma membrane. And the beta and gamma subunit, then, since they're diffusing around in the plasma membrane, can bump into other kinds of proteins, which we call effectors right here. And let's just say that this first effector on the top is an enzyme, which is normally turned off. But when this beta and gamma subunit bump into it, that's going to change the conformation of that that enzyme, and it's going to activate it. That's like poking you in the side. You're going to change conformation. So now this effector can convert other products in the cytoplasm, like converting ATP into cyclic AMP inside the cell. It would take an enzyme to do that. That's called adenylate cyclase. We'll talk about that in some upcoming chapters. So cyclic AMP levels will increase inside the cell. And what's a general way to think of cyclic AMP? What kind of name would you associate with cyclic AMP? It's what? Second messenger. So now, as this regulatory protein, right, binds to the receptor, the cyclic AMP level increases inside the cell, and that's going to change activity inside the cell. You'll have to wait to find out how that happens, right? But as the first messenger increases, the second messenger can increase, like cyclic AMP, because this is an enzyme that's going to convert ATP into cyclic AMP. Another scenario might be that the alpha subunit is going to wander around on the inside surface, partially dissolved in the membrane right here. It can bump into another kind of protein, and another kind of protein are ion channels, for instance. And when the alpha subunit bumps into an ion channel, it might cause it to go from a closed conformation to an open conformation. And let's just say that this is a sodium channel for a sodium ion. Now, where is sodium high? Outside the cell. Or low inside. So if all of a sudden you allow sodium a way to go across the membrane, which way is it going to go? It's going to go from high to low, which means it's going to go inside the cell. Now, what is the electrical charge inside the cell? Is it positive or negative? Is that going to help or hinder sodium going in? Inside is negative. And what do opposite charges do? They attract. So will that help or hinder sodium going in? It will help. So you have a big concentration gradient allowing sodium to enter the cell. You got all those negative charges sucking sodium inside the cell, right? And so that, by changing that channel, going from closed to open, that's going to drastically change the electrical properties of that cell, right? So that could be another effect of this G protein coupled receptor. It could affect enzymes that are in the membrane or ion channels. Each can have really important effects of the physiology inside the cell. And then these subunits dissociate, they come back together, the GTP is hydrolyzed. What kind of reaction is a hydrolysis? Putting together small molecules to make a big one, or a big molecule making smaller ones? Big to small. So now you end up with a guanosine diphosphate, and here's a little small molecule, inorganic phosphate coming off. Remember, that's a phosphate group, that's a PO4. One of the compounds that you have to be a little aware of, right? One of the functional groups. And now this system is ready to respond to another first messenger outside the cell. All right, so this is a way of taking a signal that's stuck outside the cell and making signals appear in the cytoplasm, right? Maybe via some electrical signals or by producing second messengers inside the cell. So this is a really nice construct that you should have pretty much memorize, the G protein coupled receptors. So one of the fascinating things is how signals are transduced from outside to inside. So that's very important. But what else is so, why do I think this G protein coupled receptor is so cool? Not because it can actually do signal transduction, which is amazing all by itself, but something even more amazing is that all cells, all living organisms have things that look and behave just like this, right? Even very simple things like bacteria. Ah, what could that be used as? Okay, what can that be used as evidence for? Evolution. Yeah, good thought, right? So if all organisms share these basic kinds of proteins and mechanisms for signal transduction, that's a very powerful argument for evolution. Can't be used as proof, but it can be used as evidence for. All right. Oh, before we go, any questions on anything in this chapter? How long did that take? Well, that took a while to get. Yeah, I couldn't have done that last time. Yeah. Do you have to know the equations? I think I have the formulas for there on the exam. You have to know how to use them. So it's not quite a physics class where you actually have to memorize the formulas. So I'll provide the formulas, but you have to know how to use them on your particular calculator. And don't forget, you can't share calculators during the test. You gotta either use mine or your own. Just like you can't share erasers or anything. Yeah. You know, for this first test, I would just like a Cypress College picture ID with your picture on it.
Okay.
Or a Fullerton College.
But, you know,
the validate. Yeah, so I have a validation sticker on mine. I don't know if you looked in your mail. It would be really nice if you had it. But if you don't have it for the first exam, that's okay. Okay. Yeah, I don't mind for this test. Yeah. But it's got to have your picture that I can see. I know I've seen some, like mine. I don't know if anybody would recognize me for my picture because it's all scraped off. Okay, so show me one that's not scraped off. Okay. Another question. Oh, I tell you what, everybody, hold on just a second. I can't quite hear because my hearing is probably going. Okay, ask me once again. The pictures I photocopy. Okay, and they'll be presented to you exactly like what you have in the study guides, except for question marks, I'll have a number, and that's where you have to write, pencil in the answer on the Scantron corresponding to the number instead of the question mark. Okay, so you don't have to draw anything, but in lab, that's a really good idea, okay, for you to draw just on a blank piece of paper. And if you're having trouble labeling a photocopy, okay, you might actually have to go back and start drawing it on a blank piece of paper. That's a step that you might have to do for some diagrams so that it sinks in really well. Okay, so if you can draw it by yourself, then taking the test is going to be really easy. Right? Yeah. Yeah, maybe some true/false. Right? So like the practice questions and the publisher's website that you use for the online quizzes. Could be questions at the end of the chapter. I could have questions from the PowerPoint slides that I liked. And then there's check your understanding questions throughout the chapter. And if you can do those, you'll have a blast on the test and the exam figures. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a calculator with me, but let's just say we can maybe do this really quick. Okay? So the question is, what is if the concentration of something is 3.62 times 10 to the minus 2 molar, what's the pH of something like that? All right? So you would have to be able to punch this number into your calculator. So if you have scientific notation, that's really handy. So what would you, on my calculator, I'd punch in 3, then 0.62, and then I would hit a little button like this, EE, which means exponent, and then I would type a 2, and then there's usually a little button on the calculator that's plus, minus. I would hit that, and then that would change that to a minus 2. Okay? All right, so then I've typed that number into my calculator using the EE and then that minus button to get a minus 2 to the 10th power. All right, and then what I would do, the simplest thing is just invert it right away. And then I would hit a button on my calculator that's 1 over X. That would invert it. And then I would hit a button on my calculator that says log. And sometimes there's a base 10 on there. The other log you don't want to touch is LN. That's a natural log. That's a different base calculation. So I would hit this number right here, and then that would give me the pH. Right? So I type in that number. If you don't have exponential notation, how could you type that number into your calculator? Okay? You move this over, it would be 0.0362. That's the same number. And then what? Take the inverse of that by hitting that button and then hitting log button, that would give you the pH. Okay? I don't know. That was simple or not.
Well,
probably if you do it 10 times, it would be simple. Yeah. Yeah. The inverse of. And you, so you unless you have a pretty fancy telephone, you probably can't do that in your telephone. And you probably should do it. You probably shouldn't have your telephones on anyway during a test.
Okay.
You could have maybe. So it's more important to know how to use this equation. The answer is A. Oh, I don't have a calculator. But I mean, on the pre-lecture reading assignment, you have a question and you have answers, right? You have the answer keys. Okay. Maybe after class, if somebody will bring a calculator up. Oh, I like that calculator. That looks like my calculator. All right, so here's a nice solar-powered. And it works in here, so don't be afraid that we don't have... We'll even have more lights on during the test. Yeah, it fluttered, so... Yeah. It needed to charge just a little bit. Okay, so what do we got right here? 3.62, right? So I go 3.62. Right there, and then I would hit this little EE button, and then we've got 2, but I want to change that. It's not 10 to the 2, it's 10 to the minus 2, so I got to hit the little plus minus right there. All right, but that's not what I want to take the log of. I want to do what? The inverse of that. So the 1 over x button, I don't need any functions, right? It's just 1 over x, just like that. And then I take the log of that, and it is 1.44. Right, 1.44 pH. Now, is that acidic or basic? That's even more important than to know. Okay, that's acidic. Remember, as the pH number goes down, what happens to the acidity? It goes up because why? It's inversely related. It's inversely related. Yeah, really good. So this is a good calculator. On eBay, which you can't get by Thursday probably, you know, you can buy those for like $5 or something. That's a nice calculator. It's a very powerful calculator. That's your favorite. Yeah, it's mine too. Okay, any other questions? Oh, you know what? Maybe I want that calculator back. Sorry. Now, you might have a question and say, how do you get the concentration knowing the pH? Well, let's just do this and see if we end up with what we started. Okay? Because you can make enough mistakes to make sure. All right, so if you want to calculate the concentration, what did I say you do? Up over here. All right, so it's going to be 10 to this power. So how do you do that on this number? I think you put the pH in, 1.44. And then I need a special function. I have a 10 to the x function. All right, so there's a 10 to the x. And so when you type this number in, it's going to be this x right here. Right? All right, so 10 to the x, so 1.44, 10 to the x, it's a second function. All right, I got 27.5, but what do we got to do to that number? We got to take the inverse of it, which is that 1 over x function again, and it is 0.036. Yeah, 0.036, right, is the number I get, right, which is equal to what? Minus 1, minus 2. So you could say 3.62 times 10 to the minus 2. This is the exact same number. Okay. So that's nice and easy and nifty. Right? And Nernst equation is really pretty much the same kind of thing. It's actually simpler kind of thing. All right. Any other questions? That was TI-36X. Solar powered. Which is great for in here. All right, so we're going to start using some of these concepts now. I wouldn't say a lot of math.
How many problems?
I can't remember how many problems. probably not more than 5. Okay? Not more than 5. Oh, you want more? I could rewrite the test.
5% math.
Okay, so something like that. I'm trying to concentrate and find the little button I have to push. That's okay. Question?
882E
is good. Get one with the bubbles not filled in. Some of the bubbles have capital letters in them. That's fine. Those are good because that's how the test is written, with capital A, capital B, capital C. All right, so now we're moving on to chapter 4. All right, so we talked about enzymes a lot in previous chapters without really knowing what they are. So, sorry about that. Sometimes you have to learn a lot all at one time, and it's just not possible to do that. What chapter did I say? Chapter 4. All right. All right, so enzymes and energy. So, basic question is, what the heck is an enzyme? And what the heck is energy? Right, so sometimes it's good to just ask really basic questions, and in this chapter we're going to learn something about what that is, but I'll tell you a little bit and then embellish some of these thoughts. An enzyme speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. It can actually take a reaction that would take millions of years to operate inside your body and allow it to happen in a split second. All right? Or it can turn those chemical reactions off so that it will take millions of years to happen. All right, so it speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. But now, what the heck is energy? What is energy? That's a really strange thing. It's energy. Let me get my arrow options going. Okay. Energy is a physical thing that allows you to do work. That's a really good definition of energy. All right, so if you're going to be down here at the bottom of the auditorium and you want to walk up to the top, what do you need to walk up on the top? You need energy to do that, right? Because you're working as you're walking up the stairs. All right, so we're going to use that concept a lot in this chapter. All right, so enzymes. A little bit more sophisticated description. Enzymes are biological catalysts that increase the rate of chemical reactions. All right, so a catalyst is something that speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. The reaction will proceed on its own anyway, but it might take forever, right? But with a catalyst, it will speed it up. But the kinds of catalysts that we're interested in, since inside our body, are not just regular kinds of inorganic catalysts. We're interested in what? Biological catalysts. And most catalysts in our body are proteins. They're made from proteins. Not all, but most of them are. Some are maybe made out of some RNA molecules, but most are made out of proteins. And they act, I'll have to tell you a little bit about this, but they act by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. So these are some important bullet points, but you have to understand what's happening right here. So let's look at some graphs. Okay, I see a couple of graphs right here. And when you look at a graph, immediately what you should do is look at the axes of the graph to see what the relationship is between a couple entities. So we have on the vertical over here the number of reactant molecules, okay, versus the energy of reactants. So we have 100 people in this class right here, all right, but you don't all have the same energy. But if I was to measure the energy of each of you, right, it would form this kind of bell-shaped curve right here. We would find some that have what? Really high energy. We'd find a few people with low energy. But most of the people would have what? Like an average amount of energy in your body. Same thing for molecules. Not all molecules have the same energy. All right, some are moving a little bit faster than others. They follow this bell-shaped distribution. All right, so don't forget, as you go from left to right on the horizontal, the amount of energy does what? Increase or decrease? The energy? The energy increases. So when you draw a graph for yourself, you know, you should put like a little arrow at the tip to know which way, how things are moving, right? So increasing energy as you go from left to right. And what about number of reactants? Down here would be a small number, and what would be up over here? A big number, right? Okay, so at a particular energy level, right, this would be the group right here that has the highest energy this would be the highest number of molecules in a group that have just an average energy right here. All right, now this bottom graph down over here is a plot of something a little bit different. We have energy on the vertical axis, and we have the progression of a chemical reaction down on the horizontal axis. So we have some molecules, right, actually going downhill. So we have reactants forming products, right? And we have what? What kind of energy is up over here compared to energy that's over here? We got high energy. And guess which way energy likes to go? From high to low. Yeah, that has something to do with something we call entropy, right? So systems like to give up energy, like to become lower energy states, all right? And you know, say this is my car. Does my car really want to roll down this hill all by itself or not? Then let's forget that this thing is not there. Oh, of course it does, okay? But in this particular circumstance, could this ball roll down the hill all by itself? What does it have to do first? It's got to jump over this fence right here or this wall. This is what we call activation energy. So it's a barrier that prevents this reaction from taking place. All right, so even though this ball wants to roll down the hill, even though products do want to form, they can't because there's this activation energy barrier. Okay. And what an enzyme does, all right, is that even though we see the same energy distribution right here, now more molecules have the proper energy to jump over this activation energy barrier because how is it compared to the first case over here? It is now lower, so that means that even though all the molecules have the same distribution and energy, you have more of them that have sufficient energy to jump over this barrier. So what does that mean in terms of product formation? It happens faster, or that you can get more product formation happening when this energy barrier, right, is reduced. And that's what an enzyme does. Okay? All right, so why is that? Oh, rats. I usually have markers here. Okay? I can use these two markers right here. Okay? And for a chemical reaction, we usually write it down this way. We have A plus B and an arrow, let's say going to the right, producing C plus D. That's a really nice case of a chemical reaction right here. All right, so everything on the left-hand side of this chemical reaction is what we call what? Reactants. And over here we call these products. Okay, and as a matter of fact, maybe what I will do in this circumstance, I'll make it a little bit more specific. I'll just say that it only produces C. Two things are going to come together to produce C. All right, and you learned a name of an important chemical reaction that does just this kind of thing. Can take two small molecules and make a big molecule out of it. What was that? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Perfect example. Okay. All right. So why does an enzyme speed this up? Well, let's just say I got these two markers right here. Okay. And the molecule that we want to build. So here is A. Here's B. The molecule that we want to build is blue on the right and black marker on the left, joined together just like that. So that's the only product. So this is the shape of the product. So how do these two markers have to bump into each other in order to make the product properly? It has to be just one way, just like that. If the markers bump into each other like that, does that form C?
No.
If it bumps in like that, does it form C? Or like that? Or like this, or like that. Or maybe, you know, we could do this a million different ways, and what is the way that it will form a product? Only one way, right? Okay. So what an enzyme does is that it takes the blue marker and the black marker and it puts them together in only one way. So it speeds up the rate of the reaction. That's what we call reducing the activation energy barrier because it puts the reactants together in just the right way to make a product. It prevents them from bumping into each other, right, in futile ways that don't end up in product. So an enzyme takes these two things, jams them together just the proper way so that a product is formed. And when that happens, that reduces the activation energy barrier, right? Okay. So the ability of enzymes to lower the energy requirement is due to the structure. Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape, conformation. We call that a conformation. And that enzyme, because of that shape, has a certain little pocket, right, or dimple on the surface of the enzyme that we call an active site into which the substrates or the reactants fit. All right, so if we have an A right here, and we got an enzyme, so here's an enzyme right here, what has got to be the shape of the active site to bind this A? Okay? Let's just say that's the shape right there. And what about the shape of an active site for B? What does that have to look like on the surface of an enzyme? Okay? It's got to look like that. And now A and B are close to each other. Now you got an A in there, right? And you got a B right in there, like that. Now they can join just fine. Okay? So so here we got the enzyme, here we got substrates, right? They can fit into the active site, and now this product, which then changes into this nifty shape right there, C, okay, is released from the enzyme. Okay, so enzymes act by bringing substrates close together so they can react. Now, if you change the shape of this active site, what happens to the activity of this enzyme? It changes, because now if this active site changes shape to look like this, it can't bind the substrate properly, and the activity is lost. Right? So you can change the activity, or you can change this active site by changing temperature, or the salt concentration, or the pH, right, which is going to change these active sites, which is going to reduce the activity of an enzyme. Okay. So here is an illustration that not as good as mine, but it's in your book, so let's go over it. Okay? So what do we start with? We got a chemical reaction, A plus B, going into C plus D. So A and B are the reactants, C and D are the products. This is just a general chemical reaction, but for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, we usually don't say reactants, we say substrates. So substrates and reactants can be used interchangeably. All right, so here's substrate A, substrate B, and then here is the enzyme, and here's the active site that will match up in a nice complementary fashion to substrate A, right? So it can bind right in here. And then here's the active site for substrate B. It will fit right in there, just like that. Now the two substrates are in the right proximity to each other, and they're oriented in just the right way so that chemical bonds can be broken or made in this area right here. So there can be rearrangements. This beast right here has got a special name. This is called the enzyme-substrate complex. That's a very important molecule. Think of it as a molecule, and this has to form before products are formed. All right, so there's a rearrangement. After the rearrangement, then product C is released and product D, and then we're back with this guy over here, the enzyme. So what's the difference between an enzyme before the reaction takes place and after the reaction takes place?
Nothing.
Color the same? Shape the same? Yeah? Okay, all these little globules in the same place? The correct answer is absolutely nothing, right? And, you know, I use color just to kind of make fun, but the important thing is look at the shape, right? This thing works because of what? The three-dimensional shape of the molecules, right? So there's no difference in the enzyme before and after a chemically catalyzed reaction. You know, in terms of the electrical properties of that molecule and any other designation you want to talk about, okay? Okay, so this enzyme is exactly the same. So this what can this enzyme do again? It can catalyze another reaction, just like that, over and over and over and over again. Okay, which is something true of all catalysts, whether they're biological or not. All right, so this might be an exam figure. Okay, so make sure you know that these are substrates. Here's an enzyme. This right here is the enzyme-substrate complex that has to form. As a matter of fact, if it never forms, if it can't form, what can you tell me about the formation of products? They don't form, right? All right, so something goes away during this enzyme catalyzed reaction. What goes away? The substrates. What forms?
Products.
All right, and what stays the same?
Enzymes.
The enzymes, yeah. Okay. All right, so that's a pretty important figure right there. We name enzymes, at least in modern terminology, all right, usually if there's an ASC at the end of the word used as a suffix, that means that that compound is an enzyme that's catalyzing a reaction, that's speeding up the rate of a chemical reaction. All right, so a word like phosphatase, you see an ASC right here, that means that it's an enzyme. Or kinase, that's an enzyme. And a phosphatase is an enzyme, because you see the ASC over here, that has something to do with phosphate groups. Okay, and this kinase is a little bit older terminology before nomenclature was completely worked out. It has to do with phosphate groups as well. A phosphatase will remove a phosphate group from a molecule. A kinase will take that same phosphate group and add it to a molecule. So a kinase adds and a phosphatase removes. Okay. So sometimes enzymes are named by the substrate that is used. So here we have an enzyme. An enzyme catalyzing A plus B going to C. Right? What would you call this enzyme right here? We could call it an ACE. A ACE. Or you could call it what? A base. B ACE. That's pretty silly to do that. I'm kind of making fun. Most substrates have names. Like, for instance, there's a sugar called lactose. Right? Lactose is a sugar, and it's broken down by an enzyme that's called lactase, for instance. Right? So ASE is the enzyme, OSE is the sugar. So a protease is an enzyme that does what? It works on proteins. It breaks down proteins. Right? And a lipase is an enzyme that breaks down lipids, for instance. So that's a really nice, handy nomenclature. Okay, dehydrogenase, we'll look at some dehydrogenases later on. So what, on this slide right here, there are some important enzymes that I do want you to know. Catalase will take H2O2, and that is what probably most of us have in our medicine cabinet at home. That is hydrogen peroxide. Okay, and hydrogen peroxide kind of looks a lot like water, and it is. Right? And over a long period of time, all that hydrogen peroxide in your bottle is going to break down into water and oxygen. But you can speed that reaction up, all right, by pouring it over maybe a part of your body that is what? That's cut. Right? And so you have a lot of tissue damage right there. Your tissues have an enzyme called catalase, which breaks down hydrogen peroxide very rapidly. So rapidly, what do you see? You see bubbles. You see those oxygen bubbles coming right up out of the wound. And that oxygen is toxic to many kinds of bacteria. And it also has a tendency to flush debris out of the wound. So it's used to clean wounds sometimes, right? Hydrogen peroxide. So that's a reaction that wants to happen all by itself, but it can't because there's an activation energy barrier there. And that activation energy barrier is taken away by what? By the enzyme catalase, speeds it up so that it happens very, very rapidly. So if you haven't switched out your hydrogen peroxide bottle in 20 years, guess what you have in there?
Water.
You pretty much have water in there, right? Because that wants to happen. Another very important reaction, carbonic anhydrase. And I'll let you key on an important molecule right here, CO2. Yeah, do we have anything to do with CO2? Yeah, our bodies produce CO2 all the time. And we have this enzyme inside our body, so it interconverts carbon dioxide, and then water, of course, into carbonic acid. So especially when we get to the respiratory chapter, we're going to be very interested in that chemical reaction. All right, and the rest, just kind of brush up on your own. And so next week, this time, this is where we're going to start up again, enzyme activity. Okay. But next time, what do you got? Yeah, you got exam 1.